Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. Can you believe it? Another week? Time flies when you're having fun. Hey, how are you doing? It's been tricky week. If you've missed my solo episode, then do go back and dive one in and you'll find out more about the lowdown there. I get so many things in my inbox on a daily basis about racism that just seeps into the everyday. The latest one, if you're a podcast listener, you'll be hearing about this before it goes up on Instagram. A colleague of mine has a teenager at a school in the Shires, so Bedfordshire, around that way. And the students were asked as part of their homework with a home learning to debate whether racism exists in the UK or not. That was a task set by the head teacher. I cannot express how urgent it is that people who are teaching the next generation engage in anti-racism work as a matter of urgency. Everybody needs to do it, but especially those who are in positions of influence and power over our young people. If it wasn't for the fact that this colleague is in touch with me and is on early stages of her anti-racism work, she probably would have engaged in that process and done that exercise. Instead, she made a complaint and said this, you know, racism is not an opinion to be debated. Racism isn't a debate, it's a discussion. And why on earth is this even homework? And they withdrew it and said they were absolutely right. This is a head teacher. I found it astounding how many people are in positions of influence and can be so damaging. And narratives, I mean, this has probably come about because of the one-dimensional narratives that we see in the press. But yeah, this work is urgent. Anyway, I've had a few of you sign up to my anti-racism course over the last week, which is incredible. So it's when this stuff gets heavy, it really is a reminder and inspiring to see you doing this and committing to doing this work. And taking that step, making that booking, taking this seriously means that you are acknowledging that you are part of the problem, which I know is painful, but it also means more powerfully that you recognize that you're part of the solution too. And that really excites me. So I look forward to being able to support more of you on that journey if this is calling you in this moment where anti-racism work has never felt more urgent. I mean, it was necessary decades and centuries ago, but here we are. You know what to do, novareed.com, to find out more about that. The course is ready and waiting for you to lean in. Before we dive into this exceedingly delicious episode, I have to let you know I've got some news. So, some of you have been asking me to set up a Patreon, and I have resisted, but I've finally taken the bullet, and it's entirely for you as podcast subscribers to build community there. It will be used to support the work I'm doing, to honour the work that I'm doing, and to help make these, producing these a bit more sustainable, because I've got a backlog of episodes and I'm really struggling to get through editing them. Most people who are doing superstar podcasts have some kind of, either they're great at editing, which I'm not, and they've got the skill set, or it's outsourced, the production and the editing is outsourced. And so that community will help support keeping these podcasts going and making sure that the work that you're getting value from is sustainable for me to continue doing it. It also means that if you are a Patreon subscriber, you get to pick my brain once a month, and I will turn your questions in a podcast episode that's exclusively for Patreon members. So I'm going to leave all of the links in the show notes. Without further ado, this podcast episode is with a brilliant, incredible Nicola Ray Wickham, who is one of my besties, incredible human being and founder of A Life More Inspired. And because we have such a close connection and we are friends, we're having such rich conversations. We're going all the way in. And what I will say is, because we do have a rapport, we talk about racism and sometimes we get a bit giggly. And we're doing that because we understand each other's vibes. But obviously it's not a laughing matter, but it's a reminder that I I do and can and sometimes need to approach this work with lightness. So enjoy the conversation. We're diving in. We're talking about how white supremacy shows up in coaching. Woo! Oh yes, we're going in. We're talking about how white supremacy feeds into relationships with each other, and that can come out as competitiveness among the black community. And we're talking about connection and the risk of being yourself, and also the liberation that comes from being yourself. Enjoy this episode. Let us know what you think over at Nova Read Official. Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Read. I am joined by the incredible Nicola Ray Wickham, who is a creative coach and founder of A Life More Inspired. Welcome, Nicola. Thank you so much for saying yes to being on my podcast.
Thank you for asking me. It's an honour.
You're welcome. So we're diving right in. Who are you beyond the roles that you have? Who is Nicola?
Beyond the roles, I am a woman who... a woman who is committed to showing up wholeheartedly and taking a whole load of other women with me. I feel like over the years, the different things that I've done, I have been very good at adopting the different roles and responsibilities. And ultimately, I've always known that just stripping it right back and being myself is almost like the revolutionary act that's always been required. And as I step further into my purpose, I know that it's about helping other women to do that as well.
Oh, lovely. So that leads into my next question. Where did you grow up and what was that like as a black person?
Well, I grew up in West London, kind of Northwest London, which is really, really diverse. So I went to a high school that was, it's a church school. And part of the reason that my parents chose it is because it was literally like a melting pot of multiculturalism. It was what the United Colours of Benetton ads were back in the day. So you had absolutely everyone from every different faith and background in this school, which was really lovely. It was so, it was so lovely. And in actual fact, even back then, we're looking at like the 90s, it was still relatively unique for around here because it's diverse, but it's still... there was still a level of segregation depending on the type of school and things, whereas this school just had everybody in it. And so I had a really lovely experience in terms of the friends I had and what I was exposed to. I mean, me personally, I was a very, very shy child. So... I've got a birthmark on my right eye, and that just made me kind of rendered me a bit mute, to be honest, until I reached my teens and I got camouflage makeup. And then I was like, I'm coming out, and I was ready to face the world. But before that, it was I was very sensitive, and I struggled with having this difference, this visible difference. So that part of it was challenging, but I was so blessed because I had the most loveliest friends around me, many of which are still my friends today. So, yeah, the experience was, personally, parts of it were difficult, but the surroundings I was in and where I grew up, it was...
You felt like you belonged.
Absolutely. Absolutely felt like I belonged.
So when did you realise you were black?
Oh my goodness, when did I realise I was black? I think, I don't have like a specific vivid memory, but I think we travelled to Grenada on holiday when I was about 6 years old. And I think going there and seeing and feeling and all the family and everything, it was like, oh, this is different to the UK. So I think that was part of it. And then also my mum, my parents' house, my mum has always had lots of like African art around. Like I'm sitting in their home now and like there's African art everywhere. There are sculptures. She's even got a little corner that she's got like a photo of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Maya Angelou. And so I knew of all of these people at a very young age. And I suppose that started to form part of my identity, because I was like, oh, why have we got that then? And they look like me. So I think maybe that's when I kind of maybe consciously knew, but I always knew, if you like, I feel like I always knew in a way.
Okay. So how you got, you have two children.
I do, yeah.
And when did you become a mother and how has that influenced your, how has that influenced your experience?
Oh, that's massively influenced my experience. Even actually, as you were talking and you'd asked me when I realised I was black, I don't really remember when I realised I was black, but I remember having my hair washed and my mum had one of those, you know, those kind of things that they, you put around your head to protect your face from like the shampoo and whatever like that. So I hadn't actually seen my hair. I hadn't seen my hair. And so I had assumed from what I'd seen on TV and everything like that, that my hair was long and flowing when it was wet. And I remember vividly. And so because my mum was using this thing to protect my eyes, because I was absolutely screaming in the bath having my hair washed, I remember vividly one day when that was removed and I looked in the mirror and I was like, Mum, what is this? Like, why is my hair not this long, flowing mane? I honestly, and I can't remember what age I was, but I remember it being a thing like, hold up a minute, what? Because you know how our hair shrinks as well. And I'm like, what is this?
Of course.
Yeah. So I think that was part of me realising then that I was black. But so that kind of likens to how my journey with motherhood and it's seeing the world through their eyes. It's noticing things like, I had thought that you could get black dolls really easily. Yeah. I just assumed, because there's so much talk about it, I just assumed. Yet when I went into the store and found it really hard, I was like, oh, actually, that's not the case. Or seeing Disney characters and being like, there's only Princess and the Frog that looks like Mia.
Little Tia. Is it Tia? Yeah, Tiana.
It's only Tiana that looks like Mia and there's all these other ones. And then also as she became more aware, her always wanting to gravitate towards the blonde-haired, white princesses, dolls. I remember us having a conversation when she was probably only about four and her saying, you can't be a princess if you've got short hair. So all of those, whereas I felt like we'd worked so hard at home to have imagery, to have conversations, showing her black beauty, yet those messages had permeated. And that was quite hard.
Those messages are powerful. And I think most of us don't realise that they're already processing, observing, not just what we do say and the actions that we take, but also what's not spoken about, what's not said, because children are forming racial bias as young as 3 years old. And I remember sharing that with you and you just being mind blown. The power of white supremacy is a powerful, powerful force.
And now, I mean, sometimes I look back and be like, well, maybe I shouldn't have let her watch TV, but I'm not that Exactly. I say that, Nova, and then I'm like, but I'm not that mother. Like, I don't know how you mother without a TV, right? So that wouldn't have been practical, realistic for me. But I do wonder if we were a household that didn't own a TV, for instance, then would that have affected things? And I know hands down it would have. Like, I wouldn't let her sit down and watch hours of Disney or Nickelodeon or anything. But ultimately, what they're watching starts to view their worldview. And yes, there are some programs, especially now, there's like the amazing Jojo and Gran Gran, which she loves.
Oh, yeah.
and things. But there aren't that many programs where they're sitting down and seeing themselves.
Mm. And I think it's beyond that as well. I think, you know, I think where we live has an influence, but it's who are they seeing in the doctor's surgery?
Mm.
Who are they seeing in banks? Who are they seeing in shops in their everyday? So it's that kind of programming, and it's just, you know, it's the society that we live in as well. So I don't think it's any one thing that influences. It's a system for sure. But interestingly enough, you were saying that from having children, it's made you see the world through their eyes, which was different to your own.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my eyes were always, I suppose even when I answered that question, there was that I grew up loving magazines. Like, I spent an absolute fortune on magazines. I wanted to be a magazine editor when I was a child, or a radio journalist. Like, that's what I wanted to do. And I absorbed them. I inhaled books. Like, that was my favorite thing, to sit in the corner on a Saturday afternoon and read a book. I was so used to not seeing myself that inevitably had an impact, but it was almost like, why would I expect to see myself?
Yeah, powerful. It is what it is. It becomes normalised.
Completely normal. So I think that whereas with Mia growing up, I expect her to see herself and she expects to see herself.
And that's a powerful difference. She expects it.
She expects it.
Whereas we didn't, because that resonates with me. We didn't. It's just the way that it is. This is what it's like. This is how things are, and just assimilate and get on with it.
Exactly. So I remember when my best friend and I started discovering makeup, and the only brand that we could afford, because Fashion Fair was like the premium brand at the time.
Oh, gosh.
And no 17-year-old was affording Fashion Fair. So it was Sleek. And Sleek wasn't what it is now. The colour palettes were really limited, but we just kind of made do. There was no going to Boots and finding...
There was nothing. Where I grew up in Hertfordshire, there wasn't even Sleek. There wasn't even Fashion Fair. All I had was Clinique.
Oh, wow.
And their nearest colour to my skin tone probably would have been a very, very... an olive-skinned person. And because there was nothing else, I used to buy it. And I literally would walk around when we would go out in these school discos where all my other friends are putting makeup on, and I would look embalmed. I would look like a dead person because my skin would be grey.
Yeah.
Because that was the only colour. Nicholas laughing. That was the only colour remotely close to my skin tone. And it wasn't even close, but it was all that was there.
It was all that was there.
Literally walking around embalmed.
There's a whole generation of us that was going out looking, because the colour of Sleek, it was like a red chalky brick colour. So
yeah.
My husband and I are different complexions, but we both wore the same colour.
It's laughable. But it's not. I remember, like, with hair as well, like, I don't remember how old I was, but I was old enough to have been out in a shop on my own, which isn't necessarily old, because my mum... more so than my dad, well, I remember it being my mum, it could have been both of them, really wanted to instill independence in us at a young age. So they would send us on errands to get milk or whatever from the shop when we were really little. And I remember I was in a shop that sold hair dye, and I had pocket money. And it was, I don't remember if it was L'Oreal, but it was a well-known brand, and it was showing blonde hair. And I thought, oh, I'm going to dye my hair blonde. And I brought this hair dye, which of course is for white hair, and it was blonde, thinking that I knew that there was, even though nobody had explicitly said it to me, I knew there was something wrong with my hair. Like, why doesn't my hair look like that on the packet? Maybe if I buy this product, it will make it look like that. And I remember my mum's asking me what I was doing, and she just entertained me, let me play around. And of course, nothing happened. And my hair came out the same, but early on I was trying to assimilate. And like the makeup, walking around embalmed.
There was a whole generation of us, like...
Nicola and I are laughing because we have... we know each other, we have a rapport. But I guess on the other side of that, I can add lightness to this work, but it's on the other side of it is absolutely bullshit.
It is. It really, yeah. really is. And what gets me angry and saddens me is that we just accept, not that we just accepted it, but it, that was just the way that it was. Like there was no, not that there wasn't any questioning, but it was just this acceptance of this is the way it is. And we weren't able to think beyond that because we didn't have the language that we do now, and the narrative was very different then. So it literally was, this is just the way that it is. And so the assimilation just happened so naturally in every fibre of us.
Because and that's now, what we've been taught.
Yeah. And now many of us have that, I feel like all women have that social conditioning to undo.
Yes.
But those of us that have had that experience have another layer of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's powerful. There's a lot to undo and there's a lot to be aware of, because if it just is second nature and you just feel like it just is what it is, then by default, we are complicit in some of it as well. And I use the word complicit not to place blame, because I assimilate as well. But just to, I guess, give the weight of the system that we were all part of and that we were all victims of in some way.
Absolutely. And it's almost like it starts then. Like we talk about our childhood. So all of us, if we looked back at our school disco, 16 years old pictures. But then if we take us at then 21 years old entering the workplace, or kind of never mind what the experience of university or higher education might have been, but entering the workplace, that assimilation was what we needed to do to survive and thrive. So that was just the groundwork to set us up to then go in the workplace. And how I've got my hair today at 39 years old, I could not have had when I had my first corporate job in fashion at 21 years old.
They would have told you that your hair was unprofessional.
I would not have got through the door.
Yeah.
I would not have got through
more
the door.
More to the point, yeah.
So it's just, I feel like that our generation has these layers to explore and to unpick. And we, in a sense, we're blessed because we're doing it in the context of now, where we've got the language and things that we didn't have, and it's a different time. So I know that if I was to go back to corporate now, I will go back as me, as I am now. But when a Black woman is struggling to connect with who she is and be herself, there's layers and layers and layers. Often on
Yeah. I remember us having a conversation about, you know, when the language of microaggressions came more into mainstream. So it's language that's been floating around the academic space since the 70s, but it's only really started coming into mainstream within the last 2 years, depending on who you are. And there were a conversation we had about work and sort of dealing with this everyday stuff. And how I hadn't realised until going through my own journey in anti-racism that a lot of what I was experiencing that was contributing to poor mental health when I used to work in a 9-to-5 was because I was experiencing these microaggressions several times a day on a daily basis. And I just wondered if you wanted to share more about that, just dealing with that in the workplace and just recognizing, like, now, oh my god, that's what was going on, and I wasn't being paranoid, and actually that low level anxiety the day before was actually really extreme because I was worried about what I would be dealing with when I walked through the door.
Absolutely. I mean, I've learned so much from you and the work that you do. So in terms of like the low level anxiety, I now know that I've experienced probably most of my life. So it started off when my birthmark appeared and kind of all of that stuff. I've always had that dread of the next day. always since being a child. It was a fear of going into school the next day of what might happen and and that kind of thing. And then it very swiftly moved into when I started work in the workplace, fitting in and not wanting to stand out. And what I now know to be as microaggressions was just the way that it is.
Yeah.
So I remember even having conversations with my parents and being like, oh, this was said or that was said, or they would come home from work with stories. And it's just that's just the way they are. That's just the way that it is. And so it's literally only now, like you said, in the last 2 years, I'm like, yeah, that's a microaggression. And that feeling of anxiety that I was experiencing was partly that, oh, am I going to stand out too much? Am I fitting in? I have to watch my P's and Q's, cross my T's and I's, because I'm the black girl in the office. I stand out. I am noticed. Mm-hmm. I am held to a different standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm representing. So if I mess up,
like the whole community.
Yeah,
literally.
If I mess up, I'm now messing it up for everyone else who wants to come in after us. And obviously there's only room for one, right? So
oh God, yeah, that too.
One in, one out, yeah. So there's all of that pressure that led to that low level anxiety, which I thought was normal. Like I thought it was normal to feel like that.
Yeah.
And only now that I realize that it wasn't. It's so empowering to be given the valid, for me, learning about microaggressions was validation that my experience wasn't me being oversensitive. It wasn't me making it up. And that actually what my parents will be like, oh, it's just the way that it is, has more of an impact. And it's okay to kind of admit that it has an impact on our mental health.
Yeah. And I also want to pick up on what you said, you know, there's only room for one in, one out. That happened throughout my life, especially when I worked in the acting industry and I would be applying to be on agents' books or be put forward for auditions. And they would be like, oh, well, we've already got a black person on our books. But what about the 99 white people that you've got on your book? So it was okay to have 99 white people, but they could only have one black person. But again, you start to if you hear something for long enough, you start to believe that it's true. Well, actually, there's only room for one of us. And then what does that create between us in our own community?
Goodness, yes.
This unhealthy competitiveness, this skullduggery, this fear that if I shine, that means you can't. And where is that coming from, that powerful system?
Absolutely. And it's it's almost that one in, one out, there's only room for one, is a lived experience and a truth that we have experienced firsthand.
Yes.
And continue to experience.
Yeah.
And so where you're saying that it becomes the reality, it does then become the reality, because we know in many cases it's like, oh, if we're doing, I don't know, a shoot, we just need the black girl. So
yeah,
me and you aren't going to both get the job because there's only one required. And you know what? I don't know if I've ever told you this, but you know how we met through wedding blogging?
Oh, yes. I sometimes forget.
Yes, I know. Like 10 years ago now, 10 years ago. So so when I first started it, I started it because I was getting married and there was no representation, blah, blah, blah. And then I remember getting the email from you. And my first reaction was, what? Hold up a minute. Like, there's only room for one.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember specifically having a conversation with my husband, and he was like, Nicola, and I even repeated this advice to a client this week. I was like, he was like, you cannot have an industry of one. I was like, wow, you come up with some gems sometimes. And I was like, yeah, you can't have an industry of one. And so I was able to release that, hold on a minute, kind of that scarcity, this is mine. Like, if there's going to be something that's servicing black women, then there's only room for one blog servicing black women, even though that there are thousands servicing white women.
Yeah.
But mostly, we really hit home. You cannot have an industry of one. And that's how I kind of really approach everything, is that the more people that are in a market, whether we want to call it saturated or busy or whatever, is good.
But it's undoing that. And also it's recognising when we're doing that, when we're feeling, because I felt it recently. It was a project that I was working on loosely, and it was a TV project. And I recently saw that Afua Hirsch has got something coming out, which is very similar to the project I've been working on. And my immediate response was, oh my God, that means my project can't happen. And I remember expressing that to someone who works in TV, and they're like, your fear is valid, because unfortunately, the people who are in positions of power and making these decisions, unfortunately, there's many of them that still operate in that way. But that doesn't mean that it can't happen in a different way. There are lots of other avenues to do projects that don't have to be via this one channel. There are now other channels. So it does, yeah, it's just, I think for us, observing that in ourselves, because I still felt that.
Absolutely.
Very recently, yeah.
It makes me even more passionate about the work that I do, because out there, the general personal development rhetoric is lack and scarcity is like a limiting belief for you to work on and release. And it's like, but the nuance to that is that some of us are approaching our lives and our work and our experience from a place of scarcity.
Yes.
Right? Like if within the last few weeks, both of us have had encounters where the reality is that there was only space for one, like with your TV project, you would have to, like what that the guy said to you. So if you're experiencing that scarcity and that's ultimately not a limiting belief.
It's a reality. It's a reality. It doesn't mean that there aren't workarounds. You have to work harder maybe, but it is also a reality.
It's a reality. And
no, no, sorry, we've already done that. Oh, but how many episodes and programs are there on food?
Mm-hmm.
But we can only have one on race.
So therefore, for you to sit in a place of abundance, it's not to say that you can't, and you do that very, very well. But there's an extra layer of work or recognition that needs to be spoken to. And I get so annoyed with the personal development industry, because it's got this broad brush approach to, okay, Nova, kind of get rid of your scarcity mindset, blah, 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 blah. But actually, if different encounters that you are having are perpetuating that message of scarcity,
yes,
then that's an added layer of nuance that you need in the work that you're doing, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's why doing anti-racism work is so vital, so that you can best support every single client that comes to you. And I'm saying anti-racism, but replace that with having better disability awareness. Whatever it is, that, you know, the client that is in front of you, they are going to be coming to you with a different set of needs based on their experiences. And if you're in a minority identity, then I think we have a duty of care to be able to provide a different service.
Yes.
That speaks to that, or that at least has a desire to listen and inquire in a way that's different to this one-dimensional, one-fits-all.
Exactly, because that does-fits-all is permeated by white supremacy. That is the model of the world, right? And it means that they are lacking the context of looking at that person. And that's my work. I see people, like, even if we don't have the same lived experience, I see them and I hear them. And then that is what we ultimately create their brand from. That's them being themselves. But there's...
And that makes perfect sense to me.
Mm. And often they've been through all of that personal development rhetoric, like they've done all of the, read all of the books and kind of gone down that rabbit hole. But there's that thing that isn't clicking. And what isn't clicking is that rhetoric isn't speaking to their experience. It's not, and it doesn't have to be someone who's lived it. It just needs to be someone who's open enough to freaking listen.
Exactly.
Listen to a model of the world that might be different to your own.
Yeah. I remember having, and I'm going to ask you more about the work that you do in a minute, because I think it's important for people to hear how you work. But I remember when I'd started running my own business full time, and I was like, right, I'm doing this properly now, going to get a business coach. And I come from a therapeutic background. I'm an NLP coach as well. So I'm very much about self-development. It's you know, I'm biased, but I think it's really important for growth. And so I was like, right, let me do it properly now. Let me get a business coach. I've had life coaches before. I've done, you know, the therapy. Let me get a business coach so I can really tackle this. And I remember we started working together, and I shared something. So the model was, you talk about whatever offerings you have, you put a Facebook ad on, and then you watch your money come in. And that was not working for me. So I'd have this Facebook ad up. And this was back before I was doing anti-racism work. So it was a generic workshop about building confidence. I was not doing any anti-racism work. Doing a bit of diversity and inclusion, but none of this stuff. And so it was about a workshop about confidence. And for some reason, Facebook algorithms thought it would be hilarious to place my advert in front of somebody, a Facebook user who endorses the Ku Klux Klan. And so what drew my attention was they commented on that advert with the words fuck off. And I thought, wow, right, this is just a workshop on building confidence. So what has elicited that? So I'm curious. So I dig around, I look in their profile, their cover photo is the Ku Klux Klan, and they've got nothing but paraphernalia talking about sort of black genocide. And I'm like, wow. So do you know what I did? I took my advert down. So it had a detrimental impact on me being able to sell my services. So I spoke to my coach at the time about that. And she compared that to people making fun of her because she wore glasses.
Oh gosh.
And it was at that point I was like, wow.
Yeah.
I'm really on my own here. I'm really on my own. So I think the power of just listening and holding space for your clients to speak their truth without trying to interject is really important.
It is. And to do the work.
Yeah.
Do the work on finding, like, do your courses, observe, consume your content and learn.
Yeah.
Because then you will have that added layer of understanding and empathy.
Empathy, boy.
Like, my approach is all about being wholehearted, and it's all about empathy. And it's like, well, if you really want to empathize, then do some of the work, like do some of the learning. And it's not like you're being required to come to the table with all the answers.
Exactly.
It just means you're able to listen from a position of better understanding.
Yeah. So that they feel supported, because one of the things that's so vital for us as black women, people of colour, is to be seen, heard and understood. And how many times is that those three components, they just don't happen. We're not seen, we're not heard, and we're definitely not understood.
And in fact, we're then erased.
Oh, Jesus, don't get me started. How long have we got? There were so many times. Yeah, I've literally been edited out of films before, like I didn't even exist, had other people take on my work like it was there. I mean, so many. But that's one of the reasons why I always say to Nicola when we have our... We talk every day,
right? We do.
But I always say that if we weren't great friends, that I would be her dream client. She would be my dream coach and dream client. So tell us more about A Life More Inspired and what you do, because I think it's so important that people hear that there is a different way for personal development, and I think you embody it beautifully. So tell me more about Wholehearted.
Oh, thank you. So Wholehearted is really the approach that I take to brand building, and it happens from the inside out. So from kind of a marketing level and a business level, all of us are operating in markets that are quite busy. I'm not going to use the word saturated, but they are busy. And how I believe that we achieve standout and are seen and heard by the right people is by us really being ourselves. But I caveat that with, we see Be Yourself splashed over Instagram and on pretty cups and on prints and kind of everywhere. But what does that really mean? And again, that is what requires the nuance. So for some of us, it will be unlearning experiences like what we've talked about today. For some, it's also about shedding the corporate persona that we've all adopted so well before jumping into entrepreneurship, as well as there being just these stories that we've adopted or been told over the years, which are stopping us getting to that place of who we really are. So what I help women do is to do that work whilst infusing who they are into their brand so that they can be seen and heard by the right people. So my work, I do it one-to-one, I do it in groups, but that's, I just absolutely light up when I speak to a woman and I'm like unraveling their story. So I've got the publicist side of me that's just like, oh, that is just brilliant. And then the other side of me that is just gently, my style is gentle, is just gently coaching them to get into a place of that realization of like, actually, I can be myself.
And it's safe for me to do so.
That's a massive part of it, it feeling safe to do so. And then also them understanding that that's where the magic is. Like, in every single person I could have in front of me, and I'd be like, even if they feel like they are the most boring person or they've had the most kind of uneventful life up to now, there are threads of their story that will connect them with their perfect clients. And for me, ultimately, it all comes down to connection. That's the thread. It's connection with yourself. That's the work that we do, reconnecting you with yourself. And then it's how we're using parts of you to connect with your people so that you can do the work that you were put here to do, do the work that you love. So it looks different for different people, but that's ultimately the framework, if you like.
As it should. It should look different for different people because we're not monolith and we're all coming from different experiences. So I am cautious of any coaching model that is a one size fits all, because it's just not going to work for everyone because of those nuanced differences, and that we're all starting from different places.
Exactly. Like, I've got one client at the moment, and she's a well woman practitioner now, so she helps women with hormones and periods and things, and she was a nurse for however many years. She always forgets the fact that she was a nurse, or kind of bypasses it and doesn't see it as important. And I'm like, the fact...
It's linked.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that you were a nurse is nothing to be... I think there's often what we don't talk about is because we're holding some shame around it.
Yeah.
So the fact that she's a nurse to her perfect fit clients is like, oh, it adds to her credibility. It adds to the breadth of her wisdom, knowledge and experience. It means that she can talk about the health system, having really been in it as now she is as an alternative practitioner. But what is most interesting for me is the story around what we don't share.
Yes.
And the shame, and it's often because we're feeling shame towards it. It's kind of like either because we feel like it didn't work out, either because we feel like it has nothing to do like with what we're doing now. So we don't want people to know. But actually, when you can reconnect with that part of you and be okay with it for yourself, it absolutely forms part of your magical, I call it your magical mix, that makes you, that we then can start to put out into the world. And that's part of what makes you unique, which from a marketing perspective is like quids in. But it's that I love talking to women and finding out, okay, so what is it you did and how did you feel, and putting that all together into their story and being like, boom, that's it.
That's the gut. And also, benefit of having Nicola as a friend, we've had these conversations as well. She's like, Nova, why aren't you talking more about the fact that you worked in mental health for 10 years and that is how you approach your anti-racism work around human behavior?
and human psychology are like, and why aren't you talking about the fact that you used to act? I'm like, because it's not relevant. She's like, yes, it is. Public speaking, confidence. So, you know, and this is only a recent conversation that we'd have, but it's really interesting you edit. And again, it, for me personally, I've been used to doing that, assimilating, playing certain roles, hiding parts of myself to try and belong or fit into certain environments, when all of those parts of me equally, I think it's really interesting how we do that.
And it's that whole, like, your whole self is okay, enough, amazing, and actually what is going to be able to connect with people. But we have been so used to being shapeshifters for whatever reason, like no matter what the experience was, we have been used to being shapeshifters and editing and filtering and modifying ourselves. And then we get to this point, and I just want women to know that actually embodying and encompassing your whole self is, like, on the other side of that is the magic.
Completely, 100%. It's just, for me, it's just liberating. It's less, it's not heavy. You know, I'm there. I'm still on the journey. I'm not finished yet. But I'd be such a people pleaser, and it was always at the expense of my own unhappiness or my health. Mm-hmm. And that's no way to operate when you are operating from a place where you can be yourself and feel like yourself. You're just more powerful, and that impact you have on the other people around you, it just has a knock-on effect.
Exactly. It's exhausting. It's exhausting to edit and to have to be second guessing everything you're thinking, and if you've now entered this place where you've got your own brand or you're doing your own thing, part of the reason you did that was for the freedom.
Yeah.
Right? You did it, and you probably did it for the freedom on, like, practical things. So it might have been freedom of time, freedom of money, kind of, but also you did that for your freedom of your soul. So, like, let's free that part of you.
Let's let the soul come out. So I have another question. What are you learning from this current climate? What is CV19 teaching you?
Oh, gosh. It is. I've actually got a list in my journal. I've got a page in my journal that is devoted to lessons from CV19. Some of them being about connection. It's amplified my belief in my message about connection being everything. At this time where we can't connect in the way that we usually would, like, I'm a hugger.
Yeah, me too.
I love being with people in person. Where we can't do that, and we have to find other ways, it's almost like connection can transcend that if it needs to. I'm learning that being yourself is what's required even more.
Tell me why.
Because at this time where there's so much uncertainty and people are going through challenging times, trying to be anything other than who you are is a level of exhaustion that no one's got the energy for.
Nope. I've not got time for that.
Do not have the time for it or the energy. And my thing has also always been about protecting your energy. And in protecting your energy, it's about really sinking into who you are.
Yes.
As well as the online space is getting busier.
Yes.
So leaning into who you are is, like I said, the way to stand out. I think I'd probably have to refer to my journal to see. Also, like, on a personal level, it's showing me how maybe at home we weren't as connected as I thought.
Powerful.
Enforced containment. It's showing me that there are, I didn't have children necessarily to be around them all the time.
Yes.
Honestly, I didn't. And now I am. So that's interesting. I kind of didn't get married to be around him all the time either, if I'm honest.
Of course, because we're individuals as well, right? Yeah. We're individuals as well. Yeah, it's revealing a lot.
Yeah, that's interesting. But also it's lending itself to spaces for connection that we otherwise wouldn't have had because we would have been busy doing other things kind of as a family. So that's,
So how do you find calm in chaos?
Okay, I find calm in chaos by voice noting you.
Ditto.
And in my journal, that's how I find calm in chaos. I've started doing morning pages again.
So can you share more about what that is?
Yes. So morning pages is a practice by a lady called Julia Cameron, where from her book Artist's Way, where you wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is free write whatever's in your mind. And it's a really good way of emptying those thoughts. So my morning pages doesn't look as prescriptive as she had kind of laid out. I have like a baby kind of clambering and trying to escape the room and things. It's interrupted, but it's still, I find really calming and magical. And other ways that I find calm is going for a walk. And just, the simple things. Yeah.
What is, so you're a reader, can you name one book that has had a profound impact on you?
It would have to be Tara Moore's Playing Big.
Play Big.
Playing Big. Because it was one of my first books that I read once I got into this kind of personal development, self-discovery journey that felt like it was speaking to a level of nuance. So it's not the level of nuance that I required or I think that is needed. I will write that book one day.
Yes.
But it was the first one that had a recognition of nuance to it. And basically she's talking about women and the reasons why we play small rather than playing big. And it just, yeah, it really, really spoke to me.
Perfect. Last question. There's two questions here. So let me just filter it into one. Who do you want to be? How do you want to serve when we come out the other side of CV19? And what do you want the world to look like?
Okay.
Or be like?
How I want to serve is to really just double down on leading by example of showing up with your whole self and your full chest and knowing that that is enough. I want to lead a movement of wholehearted women in the world that are not editing, not filtering, not hiding, but instead are owning who they are and therefore owning their magic, because I feel like that's what's going to help the world be a better place ultimately, whether it's because they infuse that into a brand that connects, which means they get to do more work, or they're just operating in their lives, going to the corporate space within their families and bringing their whole selves to the table. And I want to always lead by example with that. And how I want the world to be, I want after this, is more connected. And genuine connection, like heart to heart, human to human, below surface level conversations. Like, let's get deep, let's stop the BS, let's, like, we don't have to PR it all up. Like, let's just be real and see each other and hear each other, be open for difficult conversations, and connect on that level. Because when we connect on that level, the understanding increases and just creates space for more fluidity, more movement. So that's what I would like to happen.
more honesty, and it sounds like a world that I would like to be in. Nicola, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you so much. Before I let you go, please let my listeners know where they can find you if they want to see more about you and the work that you do.
Before I go as well, I just want to say, Nova, you are awesome. And the work that you are doing in the world is just, it's so needed. And you are absolutely the woman to be doing it. And I just want to thank you, because I have learned so much from you, and I continue to learn from you every time we chat, which is every day. So.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and you're part of that journey as well. You know, I've been on a journey, you've witnessed it as well. So it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're a very special lady. There's not many people that can do this work. Like, I certainly couldn't do it. So so my digital homes are, my website is alifemoreinspired.com, and I'm mainly playing on Instagram. Instagram stories, you often see me there with a baby strapped to my chest. but yeah, those are the two places that I hang out the most. Oh, and I've got a podcast as well called the Dream and Do Podcast.
Yeah, and you just put that in as a side note. That's worth a subscribe to as well. Thank you very, very much, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Isn't she lovely? Isn't she wonderful? Oh, she is such a joy. Again, another corker for you. I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did conversing. Just such a rich and honest and open-hearted conversation about navigating this world when you're Black, and realising when you have been complicit in upholding white supremacy without even realizing. And just, it's when you realize that, it hurts, it's hard, but it also releases you, and it can be extremely liberating. So I hope you enjoyed that and took some huge nuggets of wisdom from Nicola and some of our conversation. So connect with her over at alifemoreinspired.com. I'm going to leave everything in the show notes. Also, do check out her podcast, Dream and Do. And I must say, hot off the press, if you're listening to this on Wednesday the 13th, when we announce, Nicola is also, by divine intervention, launching a brand new membership that opens up today. And it's for big-hearted creatives with a deep desire to create a meaningful business that's purpose driven, and it's gonna be a great creative hub and a digital space and a supportive space for people who are feeling overwhelmed and stuck. So you're first to hear about that, and I believe she's offering some discounts for founding members. So if that you want to find out more about what that is and what that entails, then head on over to Nicola's website and Instagram for more. So that's it from me today. You know what to do. If this episode has resonated with you, please leave a review. I cannot wait to share the next episode with you. And again, thank you for choosing to tune into my podcast when you've got the choice of so many others, and for engaging in and sharing this corner of the internet with me. Again, reminder, if you are interested in a Patreon, check out the links in the show notes. Take care of you. Have a good week.